All right, I'm going to call the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Good to see everyone. Please, as always, mute your feeds when you're not speaking so that we can have all hear better. And the first order of business today is to have the roll call. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would call the roll, please.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Eklund.
Present.
Acker.
Acker present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Bamuth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Keel. Keel. Morrison.
Present.
Munson.
Munson present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgemut.
Present.
There, a quorum is present.
All right, thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present. So next, we will entertain a motion to approve the minutes of February 9th.
So moved.
All right, thank you, Representative Freiberg. Representative Freiberg moves approval of the minutes of February 9th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none, if you would please unmute yourselves and all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you so much. Okay, well, we are excited today that we have a presentation from Dr. Rachel Hardeman on Black maternal health, getting at the root causes of inequity. And I think I saw Dr. Hardeman there. She is. Dr. Hardeman, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it. And if you would just, I don't know if you've done a lot of testifying in these committees, but if you would just introduce yourself for the record, just tell us your name and give us, I see you've got it all on the slide anyway, but just tell us your institutional affiliation, and then please just go ahead and give us your presentation. I'll ask members to hold questions until the end, and I'll be keeping a list as hands go up. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rachel Hardeman, and I am an associate professor and the Blue Cross Endowed Professor of Health and Racial Equity at the University of Minnesota in the School of Public Health, Division of Health Policy and Management. And I'm grateful to have the opportunity to be here with you all today to share some of my research on inequities in maternal and infant health. So I will jump right in. You can go to the next slide, please, Alyssa. Thanks. So what we know is that each year in the United States, between 700 and 900 women die of pregnancy-related causes, which actually makes the United States the only developed country in the world with the highest and increasing maternal mortality trend, or maternal mortality rates. And maternal mortality refers to a death that occurs during pregnancy or within 1 year postpartum from a pregnancy complication or a chain of events initiated by pregnancy or the aggravation of an unrelated condition by the physiologic effects of pregnancy. And in the United States, it's become clear over the past several years that maternal mortality is a clinical, public health, and a social crisis. Next slide, please. We also recognize that the risk for maternal mortality is unevenly distributed, with some populations bearing substantially greater risk. Among the groups at high risk for maternal mortality are Black and Indigenous birthing people. So Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die of pregnancy-related causes than their non-Hispanic white counterparts. And that statistic is true regardless of education and socioeconomic status. So even Black women who are highly educated and in high SES, high socioeconomic status are still at greater risk than their white counterparts of experiencing maternal mortality. Next slide, please. So what does this look like in Minnesota? So I currently have the honor of co-chairing the Minnesota Maternal Mortality Review Committee, where we continue to review maternal deaths in Minnesota and provide surveillance as well as offer recommendations for change in practice and systems of support as well as inpatient education. And what we know right now about maternal mortality in Minnesota is that historically in Minnesota, maternal deaths have been caused by reasons such as hemorrhage, infections, and complications from delivery. But in recent years, we're starting to see a shift. We've seen more deaths attributed to motor vehicle accidents. We've seen more deaths attributed to chronic health conditions such as hypertension and diabetes. Also similar to a trend that we're seeing across the country with respect to maternal mortality, here in Minnesota, we've seen an increase in maternal deaths that are occurring with substance abuse, our substance use, depression, suicide, and gun violence. So the current data we have on maternal mortality in Minnesota tells us that Black women are 2.3 times higher than to experience maternal, or 2.3 times more likely to experience maternal mortality. The indigenous maternal mortality rate is approximately 4 times higher than that of white mothers in Minnesota. I think it's also important to note as we think about this issue that our current data here in Minnesota suggests that almost half, so 47% of maternal deaths occur in greater Minnesota. Next slide, please. And I think we can't talk about maternal mortality without also talking about infant mortality, because preserving the lives of newborns has certainly been a long-standing issue in public health, as well as in social policy and other humanitarian endeavors. High infant mortality rates are generally indicative of unmet human health needs. And so over the years, we've seen infant mortality decline because we've had better sanitation and medical care and nutrition and education. But what we continue to see persist with respect to infant mortality is the racial inequities. So while infant mortality over time has declined quite a bit, the gap between Black and white babies has persisted. And the same is true for Indigenous babies as well. So next slide, please. So here in Minnesota, what we know is that, overall our infant mortality rate is one of the best. It's one of the lowest in the country. But then when you peel back the layers and look at those data by race, what we see is that Black and Indigenous infants are less likely to celebrate their first birthday. Next slide, please. So the question, that I think we have to grapple with, and what the question that I grapple with in my research is, what's at the root? What's the root cause of these two persistent inequities in maternal and infant health? And so today I'll spend my time talking about the notion that racism is a risk factor for maternal and infant inequities. And by racism, I'm referring, in this context, I'm referring to the normalization and the legitimization of an array of dynamics from historical to cultural, institutional, and interpersonal. We're not talking about individual people, but really an institution or a system or a structure that has routinely advantaged white people while producing cumulative and chronic disadvantage and adverse outcomes for people of color. So I'm referring to a system of hierarchy and inequity that offers preferential treatment and privilege and power for white people at the expense of people of color. I also include this on this slide, the diagram showing implicit bias and structural racism, because I think it's important for us to understand how the two work hand in hand. Implicit bias is an important part of structural racism and refers to the process of associating stereotypes or attitudes towards categories of people without conscious awareness. So it's in our unconscious, our automatic sort of thoughts. And the reason for that is because that's how we've all been sort of socialized and programmed over, from the time we're very small to think about race and to think about different groups of people. But I think what's important to understand is that we have to be tackling both implicit bias and structural racism to really achieve reproductive health equity or any type of health equity in our communities. Next slide, please. And because I'm a In a school of public health, I think it's important to use a public health framing to really understand and dig into this topic and these issues. Hopefully many of you are familiar with the term, the social determinants of health, right? So the idea that where we work, live, and play matters for our health. And I think that's absolutely 100% true. You know, we know that health does not occur in a vacuum and that it's deeply embedded in our communities and in those social conditions. But we also know that health is shaped by, you know, distribution of money, power, and resources. And I think, you know, where we're falling short is really understanding the why of the social determinants of health. And so what I would offer today is that when we think about the social determinants of health, we have to think about why do those social determinants matter for health and well-being? So why does education and access to quality education matter? Why does access to quality healthcare matter? And at the root of that is structural racism. So structural racism is what dictates who gets a high quality education. It's certainly what dictates who is able to live in a safe community that is free from violence. It dictates options for jobs and also how one might get to their job. And so without making those connections, we can't really begin to dig into what we do to change these inequitable outcomes. Next slide, please. So now I'm gonna offer a few slides that just share some of the evidence, some of my research and the research of my colleagues that really I think exemplifies sort of the big problem we're grappling with. And so some of what I will talk about is really on that sort of structural level of it's the social conditions and the social determinants, but also some of what I'll talk about is very much about how it's deeply embedded in our healthcare systems, our healthcare delivery systems. Next slide, please. So in my work and looking at the connections between structural racism and maternal mortality, we ask, are there associations between county level indicators of structural racism and maternal mortality among non-Hispanic, Black, and white populations in the United States? And the ways that we operationalize or think about structural racism for these analyses are around educational attainment, employment, household income, prison rates, and jail incarceration rates. We also measure some overall measures of structural racism. So looking at sort of high versus low structural racism in various counties, and also looking at sort of concentrations around income to understand this issue more broadly. Next slide, please. And due to time constraints, I won't, you know, read all of the words on this slide. I think you all have access to the slides, so you know, feel free to take a look at your leisure. But what you see is that we found significant associations between most of the structural racism indicators that we studied in maternal mortality. We found that overall structural racism in a county was associated with a 37% increase in Black maternal mortality. And I think one of the big takeaways for me from this study in particular is that, you know, I think these findings suggest that, you know, targeted policy solutions are going to be necessary to improve inequitable outcomes in maternal mortality. And those targeted policy solutions may not necessarily lie directly in health policy, right? So the fact that we see prison incarceration is associated with a nearly 30% increase in Black maternal mortality suggests that this issue is much bigger than how we deliver healthcare. Next slide, please. Thanks. So, you know, as I described when showing you the slide with the social determinants of health, you know, what we know is that social context matters for health and well-being. And in this particular research, you know, we argue that there's a critical need to identify how social contexts that have been impacted by, in this case, racialized police violence, shape population health outcomes and contribute to racial health inequities. But before even digging into the question of how does police violence as a form of structural racism impact birth outcomes or maternal and infant health outcomes, we start by actually looking at police contacts. So what does it mean to live in a community where there is a disproportionate police presence? Because what we see here in Minneapolis in particular, this study our data come from Minneapolis. And what we see is that Minneapolis is highly segregated by race, and communities or neighborhoods where that are have more Black people living there are more likely to experience surveillance by police. And so what we found in our study in these Minneapolis neighborhoods is that Minneapolis neighborhoods with more Black residents have a higher incidence of police contact. So they're more likely to just have police being patrolling in those communities, in those areas, and that pregnant people who reside in those neighborhoods with high police exposure have a significantly more risk of experiencing a preterm birth, meaning a birth before 37 weeks of gestation, so giving birth too early. We're also analyzing data right now from a survey and interviews with Black pregnant people and mothers in the Twin Cities about how living in communities where high profile events of police violence have occurred impacts their stress levels, their pregnancies, and the decisions that they make about parenting. And I'll soon be launching a national study that will actually be able to examine the associations of police violence and preterm birth, low birth weight, and infant mortality in communities across the country where there's been a high profile event of police violence over the past decade. Next slide, please. And so as I mentioned earlier, you know, this issue of inequity and racism is also happening within the walls of our healthcare systems. So we have all of the social contexts that people live in, and the barrier is there, but also once they access the healthcare system, they're not always getting the high quality, equitable care that they need and deserve. And this slide just offers three different papers of many that are examples of the experiences in particular that Black birthing people or Black women have shared over the years. So in one study, Saraswathi Vadam and her team at the Birthplace Lab, they conducted a large national survey and found that 1 in 6 women report experiencing one or more types of mistreatment, such as loss of autonomy, being shouted at or scolded, being threatened, being ignored when requesting or asking for help. In that middle paper, Dr. Monica McLemore and her team at UCSF, they report that birthing people of color report experiencing disrespect during healthcare encounters, including experiences of racism and discrimination. They also talk a lot about the stressful interactions they have with staff across the board, so not just the clinician, but clinic staff generally. They report unmet information needs as well as inconsistent social support. And then in that third paper is my work with my colleague, Dr. Laura Atanasio. And we looked at a national sample of women who gave birth in the United States and found that women who reported having declined a care procedure for themselves or their infant during that childbirth hospitalization period were more likely to report poor treatment based on their race. And also we found that there was an increase in odds of discrimination due to a difference in opinion with a healthcare provider, and that was significantly larger in magnitude for Black women compared to white women. So essentially, when Black women decided to voice a concern or something that sort of didn't go or went against what a provider, a clinician was saying, the result of that experience was sort of feelings of discrimination throughout the rest of the care that they received. Next slide, please. Thanks. So additionally, and this is my last sort of example within the healthcare system, is a piece, is a paper that I published with three colleagues a few months ago, I guess over the summer in August, where we were really interested in understanding if patient-physician racial concordance improved outcomes or not for infant mortality. And just to be clear, patient-physician racial concordance means that the patient shares the same racial background as their provider. And what we know from previous work is that when, particularly for Black and Latinx, there's work that's also been done in the Latinx community around this as well, but in Black communities, when in the studies with Black communities, when a Black patient is cared for by a Black provider, We see higher levels of satisfaction with the care. A recent paper from a great group of economists found that healthcare utilization rates were higher. So primary Black men were more likely to access primary care when they were being cared for by a Black provider. But what we didn't know until this work was if racial concordance matters for outcomes, for the health outcome itself. And so that's what we looked at in this paper. This slide shows an article that was written about our work and about my work in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago. So we examined data on hospital births in Florida from 1992 to 2015 and found that when attended by white physicians, when cared for by white physicians, Black newborns experienced 430 more deaths per 100,000 births than white newborns. But when cared for by a Black physician, the excess deaths dropped to 173 per 100,000 above that of white newborns. And so I think there's a lot to think about. I think there's a lot to think about when, you know, as we examine sort of what's going on here, primarily because, you know, we rely on sort of this understanding of the communication piece as an important part of the patient-provider relationship or that encounter. But when we're talking about newborn babies, that communication piece doesn't exist. And so to me, that suggests that there's a lot of work that we have to do to undo some of those implicit biases and things that I mentioned earlier to ensure that everyone is getting high quality and optimal care. Next slide. And then I'll close just with a couple of thoughts on, you know, I do my research really to ensure that we can be thinking about what's next and how to create solutions, policy solutions to these large sort of population health level issues. And so, you know, I think clearly what my work and others has shown is that we have to invest in the social determinants of health. We know that, you know, where you live, work, and play matters for health and certainly matters for reproductive health. And so, you know, by focusing on policy that feels like it has less to do with healthcare, but still will have a significant impact on health outcomes. So housing and transportation, access to nutritious, you know, foods, and things like that. Even, you know, thinking about sort of the historical implications of redlining and racial segregation and what that's meant for communities across our state. You know, I think there's a lot of incredible community-based Black and Indigenous-led organizations working in this space that need to be amplified and need resources and support to do the work. I would love for us to be thinking about how do we grow and diversify the perinatal workforce as well as the healthcare workforce more generally. So what we know is that nationally, you know, Black people make up 13% of the population, but only 5% of clinicians identify as Black. Even fewer identify as Indigenous. I think we have a lot of work to do around improving data collection processes and really creating quality measures that help us to both understand and track the maternal and infant healthcare crisis, both here locally as well as across the state. So, you know, I co-chair the Minnesota Maternal Mortality Review Committee, where we are, you know, hopeful that we will be able to expand the scope of our reviews to be able to better identify and target those root causes of maternal mortality and morbidity. I think we should focus on supporting innovative care models and payment models. So I do a lot of work with Roots Community Birth Center, which is a freestanding birth center in North Minneapolis. And, you know, we've had a research relationship for almost 5 years now. And what we've seen is that the model of care that they deliver has had some pretty impressive outcomes. So no preterm birth babies, no low birth weight babies, but, you know, we have a lot of work to do to figure out how to make that model sustainable and also to figure out what elements of that model can be transferred to other spaces where people are giving birth and receiving prenatal care. And, you know, I think we also have to think about what it would look like to require that our care providers go through implicit bias and anti-racism training. And so my last slide is just to point you towards a project I'm leading with another state where that has passed legislation requiring that all of their perinatal care providers go through implicit bias and anti-racism training. And so we are and we're nearly finished creating the one hour e-learning modules for that training. And that's not to suggest that it's, you know, take the training and you're done and like the problem is solved. But I think it's an incredibly important step towards both signaling the importance of, you know, intervening on this issue as well as getting people sort of started down a path of figuring out what needs to be done within the settings in which they work. Next slide. So I just want to thank my colleague, Alyssa, who's been advancing the slides and helped put together this presentation. And I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hardiman. And thank you, Alyssa. We miss you over here. Alyssa, you know, was working at the house until recently. So
I feel very lucky to have recruited her over.
Oh, I thought you were going to say guilty. Oh, dear. Okay. Well, anyway, that's great. Thank you so much. So let's see. Questions from members. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have lots of things that I would like to talk about or questions that I have, but maybe I'll just start out for two. And then if their time permits, I'll get back on the list for another round. So thank you. I guess the where I would like to start, if we could with, I mean, you were describing that model of something where you had some very favorable outcomes. Mm-hmm. And I would like to if you could go into more detail about that and, you know, the kind of policies that would have to be put in place to have this this model be expanded and really rolled out in a way that would have an impact.
Dr. Hardiman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So the model I was referring to is led by Rebecca Polson, who is a midwife here in the Twin Cities. And she, about 5 years ago, opened Roots Community Birth Center, which is a freestanding birth center. It's located in the Camden neighborhood in North Minneapolis. And, you know, so for those of you who aren't familiar with a freestanding birth center, it exists sort of independent from, you know, midwifery-led you know, hospital sort of services, but Roots has over the years built some incredible partnerships with OBGYNs and has privileges at, you know, North Memorial and other hospitals across the Twin Cities, because sometimes people do need that to have, you know, transfer care and they need to have those relationships. But, you know, I think what we've seen at Roots is they have very intentionally created a space for that sort of meets the needs of the community and whatever that, and that may be different from one family to another, and they've been able to sort of respond in that way. You know, some of what they do are things that are really hard to do in sort of the more traditional healthcare setting because of how we charge for care, right? And the fact that, you know, I don't know any OBGYN, Representative Morrison, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know any OBGYN that is able to take an hour to have an appointment, right, with a patient and their family. At Roots, they do a lot of that work. They have a postpartum model of care that allows for home visits as well as visits into the birth center for those 6 weeks postpartum. But I think the point is, I think a lot of the care that they're providing is necessary, particularly for the population they're caring for, but is not necessarily reimbursable because of the way our current system is set up. And so they're often sort of trying to figure out ways to piece all of that together. You know, there's other elements of the model of care, and we actually have a publication that I would be happy to share with the committee if it would be helpful, that sort of helps to kind of outline, you know, what that model looks like from what Rebecca refers to as a sort of culturally centered model of care. And I think a lot of it is about relationship building, which takes time, it takes intention, it takes building trust. And, you know, one of the newest things that they've, that's come out of Roots and actually this week is they just announced that they, because so many of the families that they care for during the prenatal and postpartum period say they want to keep getting their care at Roots, but they're done, right? And so they've recently hired a family medicine physician who will be able to then offer this continuity of care for families who want to stay in this sort of alternate system. But I also don't want to suggest that freestanding birth centers are the solution, right? Because I think it's one piece of like a bigger picture that we need to be thinking about. And not everyone can birth in a freestanding birth center, right? I mean, right now because of insurance, but also because if you're high risk, that's just not, you're risking out of that type of care. And so, you know, one of the things we're working on now is trying to sort of piece together the elements of the model that can be transferred or translated to other settings in a way that will allow for that same, you know, a similar type of care and, you know, to happen for patients who need it.
All right, well, thank you. So, wow, well, there's a lot of interest in this topic. I have four members who want to ask questions. So I have Damoth, Grunhagen, Ryer, and Quam. So Representative Damoth, please go ahead. And Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Dr. Hardiman, thank you so much for your testimony. I vividly remember that when you presented in September on the Select Committee of Racial Justice. And so thank you for bringing this forward. To your point about knowing the better outcomes when the patient or the baby or the mom is the same race as the doctor, that drives home that point that we have to close our achievement gap in Minnesota, that we can't expect to have more health professionals of color if we're already failing them early. So without a doubt, that again feeds into that. But just a brief question. You had talked about 47% of the maternal deaths actually happen in greater Minnesota. Is there a breakdown according to race, or was that overall when you gave that stat?
Dr. Hardiman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So we don't have the breakdown by race for that. As we review more cases, we'll hopefully be able to offer sort of more detail in that way. I mean, one of the things that we, struggle with as we review, so maternal mortality is a horrible outcome. But it's actually not a super frequent one, right? So, we are sort of, as we accumulate more cases over more years, we'll be able to sort of look at things those intersections of, geography and race. But right now we can't. We just don't have the numbers.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
Jamuth, are you?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again, Dr. Hardiman.
Okay, very good. Representative Grunhagen, then Ryer, Quam, Morrison. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hardiman, for your presentation. It's interesting, I'm on the Preventative Healthcare Committee, and we just dealt with a bill this morning to extend Medicaid coverage for moms from 60 days to 12 months. And everyone was supportive of that bill on both sides of the aisle. So I think that'll be coming here eventually. But I think that's a key area. My question, the other thing I just share with you is that several sessions ago, Senator Hoffman, John Hoffman, DFL, and I were chief authors on a bill to educate and increase access for Somali women. There seemed to be some concern that they weren't going to the medical clinics for care. So we actually chief authored that bill, and they invited us down and took pictures, and we worked with some of the Somali community in order to get that passed. And Governor Dayton did sign it, by the way. I appreciate. The other question, and the death of a child has got to be one of the saddest things a family can possibly go through, especially a mom. I can't think of anything harder than that. And I've seen that in my own extended family that's happened. But on your studies, as far as the analysis, do you break it down as far as deaths in a married couple versus living together couple versus single moms. You break it down into those categories as far as the deaths are concerned?
Dr. Hardiman?
Thank you. So in our particular analysis that I presented today, we do not. We certainly can, and there's plenty of work that has looked at that, and it actually doesn't matter. It's not a significant predictor of maternal or infant mortality. And so, you know, we certainly in our demographics will report, you know, both age and marital status and things like that, but it hasn't been shown to significantly predict that outcome.
Madam Chair? Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the reason I did jail ministry for 13 years, and we had men and women in there, and some of the women were pregnant. And the other thing I'd just share with you, and again, I did it for 13 years, is that a lot of the pregnant women that were in jail were using illegal substances, okay, and had been arrested either with their boyfriend or for selling drugs themselves. And it didn't matter in terms of what ethnic group they were with. It was represented right across the board. But it would be interesting to know, I think, the breakdown I talked about before, plus the addition of, were there illegal substances in the family or during that pregnancy, where the death of the baby occurred? Do you take that into consideration?
Dr. Hardiman.
Thank you. So what we've seen over the years is that even when we take that into consideration, it doesn't shift the outcomes, right? So essentially, the more things that, you know, so we call it in our statistical analyses, we would say we're controlling for these high risk behaviors, right? So tobacco use, substance use. And even when in our models, when we control for that, we see that the disparities are persisting. And so I think, you know, one of the things, the reason I don't specifically focus on that is because to me, you know, when we go back to that social determinants of health model, right? And when we understand that people are products of the environments in which they're exposed to, if we're not fixing the environment that has allowed whatever risky behavior, you know, to happen, then we're doing them a disservice, right? So it's not necessarily about these sort of individual failures of a person that has resulted in an adverse outcome, but really thinking about how do we change the environment? How do we change the community? How do we change the sort of opportunities that allow people to live healthy and thriving lives, right?
Okay, Madam Chair, thank just you. One more quick question.
Representative Gernhagen, I have three more members that have their hands up, so I'm going to move on if that's okay.
Okay.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, Dr. Hardiman. I appreciate you being here today and sharing this information. So I'm thinking about where to go with this as a legislator and as a policymaking group and looking at your potential policy solutions. I'm thinking, just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the barriers that you see in driving that level of change based on the assumption that structural racism is at the core of the social determinants of health and a lot of, and basically the driver of where we are now. What are the recommendations you'd have, the leverage points that we might be able to find, especially in the case of this group being a group of white legislators who are thinking about these problems? And you know, I don't have a real specific question, just more general direction. So thank you.
Dr. Hardiman.
Thank you. That's a huge question. Okay. I mean, I think one of the sort of very immediate barriers is that we don't have, I mean, everything I've talked about with the ways that we've measured structural racism is our best guess, not guess, but it's our best sort of stab at operationalizing something that is huge, right? And that is sort of so deeply baked into all of what we do and how we operate that I think it's really hard to get at specifically at the question of how is racism operating here. And so, you know, I think we certainly need to think about how to fund more work in that space to really sort of bring that to life. And I think that there's an important role for community who are marginalized, historically oppressed and historically marginalized, to play a role in really highlighting what that means and what that looks like in their day-to-day experience. And then I think, you know, I think it's going back to, you know, I think the most important thing, which feels still very broad too, is really investing in how do we, in the social determinants of health, right? And how do we really identify, you know, someone had mentioned sort of the pipeline issues, but, you know, if we're gonna diversify the healthcare workforce, I mean, that requires that we take a close look at how, you know, how all of our schools across different communities are being resourced, right? And it's gonna require that we think differently about, you know, how the achievement gap, and particularly within the context of the ways that COVID-19 has played out in different schools and different communities. You know, I think it's going to take thinking about opportunities for affordable and sustainable housing in a different way, and building, and also, frankly, it's gonna take grappling with some thorny issues around policing and public safety, and thinking about what it actually means to defund the police versus, you know, reform versus, you know, it's gonna, and so I guess I feel like that's not a very satisfying response, because it's all of that end, right? And so, you know, and I think it, and I recognize that it all can't happen at once, certainly, but every sort of lever is, I think, an incremental, you know, step in the right direction.
All right, thank you. So I have Quam Morrison Schultz, and then I think we'll go on after that, because we do have Representative Richardson here to present her bill. So Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. My mother-in-law for decades did labor and delivery, Saudi Arabia, a hospital in a poor part of LA, and several other states. And we had many discussions about some places did things that were more effective. There were cultural differences, especially, you know, with non-doctor births, prenatal care, and et cetera. In your study, I was hoping to see more of glimpses of locations where things work better and we could cross-pollinate. I know there are some very active organizations in North Minneapolis that have had success in different issues. And, you know, on a more positive note, it'd be nice if offline you could share with the committee where you've seen indications of success and some of those activities. I know in Dallas, a group of us would volunteer during the summers, and we'd go to a park in a area of the city that was more economically challenged and medically challenged. And so we would have a clinic and do vaccinations and screenings, and a lot of prenatal care and, you know, care for young children was involved. I mean, some of those type of access, delivery, and reaching out to communities that maybe are underserved. It'd be great if out of your studies, you had some good examples that we could build from and try and help improve our systems in the state. Too often we hear just about the bad stuff, but I think there are some places where good things are happening. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quam. Dr. Hardiman?
Thank you. I completely agree. There are places that where good things are happening. I think, you know, Roots Birth Center is certainly one of those examples. And one of the, you know, and I'm happy to share some other thoughts offline as well, as you requested about that. And maybe I'll pause there given the time.
All right. Thank you for that. Okay. Yeah, no problem. Representative Morrison and then Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be brief too. It's very exciting to have Dr. Hardiman here at our committee, and I could pull her aside and talk to her for hours. But really, our state and our entire country owe you a debt of gratitude. Your work to elevate and to better understand these issues has been transformative in Minnesota and across the country. I hope everyone on the committee and people who are listening understand what a rock star we have with us today. So I just want to express my gratitude to you for your work. Particularly the study done on the babies in Florida, that was one that I think no one could look away from. That was a pretty stunning study that I think served as a wake-up call for some people who may have been skeptics about the challenges that we're facing. I'm excited to hear Representative Richardson's bill because I think it incorporates a lot of the suggestions that you pointed to. And I also want to point out Representative Grunhagen brought up an issue that I think is part of this. You know, as you mentioned, there's not one silver bullet. It's going to take a lot of different things to improve the situation. But we're talking about women who had used substances in jail. I was thinking those women probably didn't belong in jail. They probably should have been in treatment, getting the care that they needed. And I'm bringing the bill forward again this year to exempt providers of prenatal care from being mandatory reporters of women who use substances during their pregnancy. You know, you, Dr. Hardiman, you referred often to building trust, and right, our healthcare system is not set up to have extended visits for patients. And it takes time to build trust. We need to do everything we can to be improving trust between providers and patients. And some of that is making sure that providers are on the same side as the patient. Someone who thinks that they are going to be reported by their healthcare provider is not going to come see that healthcare provider. And expanding access to care is a piece of that as well. So I'm not sure I have a question. I mean, I have 100 questions that I'd love to ask you, but I won't do that right now. A lot of your talk made me think we need to do much better in terms of data collection. And I think you mentioned it as well. We need to disaggregate and make sure that we're getting the best information so that we can make the best informed policy. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Representative Schultz.
I just want to echo that. We are very grateful to have Professor Hardiman here in Minnesota and in this country studying these issues. So thank you for all the work you're doing. I know it's not easy being a professor and moving up the ranks. I just want to mention that I'm working on a bill to expand the pathways for certified midwives. And I'm just wondering, what's important when we look at certification of midwives, and how can we, you know, you don't have to answer this now, but maybe if you can reflect and give feedback, and maybe Representative Richardson's going to do this as well, but what should we be looking at when we certify? What sorts of training will help us do what we can to address these disparities in infant and maternal mortality rates? It may help to expand to get more women and women of color into the pipeline to care, to be in these, you know, caring careers like midwifery. But if you can reflect on that and give us input, the bill, we haven't dropped the bill yet, but it's being worked on.
Dr. Hardiman, did you want to respond?
I would love to, thank you, Madam Chair. I would love to, Representative Schultz, chat with you or be in touch with you about that. Both, that's something that both I and my colleague, Rebecca Polston, have thought a lot about. And so, I look forward to being able to connect about it.
All right. Well, Dr. Hardiman, I just want to echo the thanks from some of the members here. We really appreciate you being with us today and giving us your report and really laying the ground now that we're gonna hear from Representative Richardson on her bill that addresses this very topic. So thank you so much. Thank you for your work, and we look forward to working with you some more in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And before we turn to Representative Richardson's bill, I know everybody noticed we sent out to you a copy of the report from the Select Committee on Racial Justice, which you've heard referred to a little bit here today. And I just wanted to note on there that there are several proposals that relate to our committee. Mainly, I just want to really encourage everybody to go and read the report. I found it very interesting, and it really does lay out a lot of the background and is very good. And there are a number of proposals in there, many of which actually members are already working into bills, putting into bills that are specifics that are before this committee and also before Human Services. So that's really great. And one of those, as it happens, is a proposal called Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act, which, coincidence of coincidences, is before us today, House File 660. So the chair will move that House File 660 be recommended to be re-referred to Judiciary and Civil Law. And just so members know, this bill will go to Judiciary. The expectation is that it will come back to this committee because it will have a fiscal note. And so it'll come back to us, and the intention would be to lay it over to be for possible inclusion in our finance bill, but it's got a little bit of a path before it gets back to us. So welcome, Representative Richardson. Your bill is before us, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an A1 amendment.
Okay. So I will move the A1 author's amendment. Representative Richardson, do you prefer that we just adopt it and then you can explain the bill as amended? Or do you want to explain the A1 first?
Madam Chair, I can explain the A1 amendment quickly.
Okay, please do.
The A1 amendment makes a number of technical changes. The most significant amendment changes the definition of morbidity or the near misses from the ACOG definition to the Centers for Disease Control definition, which would allow the opportunity for the study and enhance learning from a larger pool of morbidity incidents. It inserts a definition of records, and it adds family home visiting, the WIC program, prescription monitoring program, and behavioral health service program records to the bill as well. And it adds a timeline on relevant records of postpartum care received up to 1 year following the end of pregnancy, adds an additional law enforcement reference, and also inserts language to accommodate a future fiscal note, as you discussed.
Okay, so let's go ahead then. And is there any discussion to the author's amendment, the A1? All right, seeing none, if members would unmute yourselves, and all those in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Richardson, then, if you would want to just describe the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 660 is a bill that takes some important steps forward in addressing the persistent and unacceptable outcomes we continue to see in Minnesota and around the nation related to maternal infant mortality and morbidity. The data is troubling. Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related deaths than white women. To put it another way, Black women are 243% more likely than white women to die of pregnancy or childbirth-related causes. Another startling fact is that the majority of these deaths, over 60% of them, are preventable. While the general public may assume that Black women have higher risks of complications during pregnancy solely because of poverty or education or individual choices, research proves that assumption is incorrect. When you control for general health, marital status, education, income, substance use disorders, and other factors, Black women are still more likely to suffer serious pregnancy complications and death. In fact, Black college-educated women are still more likely to suffer serious pregnancy complications compared with others who have never graduated high school. In addition, at every income level, we see these disparities. The near-death experiences of Beyoncé Knowles and Serena Williams brought national attention to this issue. In the case of Serena Williams, she recounts being in her hospital room and beginning to gasp for air after an emergency C-section. She got out of bed and flagged down a nearby nurse to alert them that something was seriously wrong and that she needed a CT scan to check for blood clots and a Heppinger. The nurse disregarded her request, believing that she was confused from her medications. Eventually, a doctor arrived and only performed an ultrasound, not a CT scan, that Williams had asked for. The ultrasound revealed nothing. Williams continued to request a CT scan. Eventually, the providers relented. They followed her request, and the CT scan revealed that she had several blood clots in her lungs, and they immediately began medication. A six-day medical crisis followed. Suffering from severe coughing, she opened up her C-section incision, and a subsequent surgery revealed a hemorrhage at that site. And while Williams' story brought national attention to this issue, there are the names of so many other women that you don't know. Women who pleaded for help along with their spouses, and those voices were not heard. Women like Amber Rose Isaac, who pleaded for help before her death. Or Shaiasia Washington, who voiced concerns over and over again to her providers and doctors and nurses, and she was ignored. She died shortly after posting her concerns about her treatment on social media. The research and the heartbreaking stories of loss tell us that Black women cannot educate their way out of this problem by earning advanced degrees. We cannot healthcare access our way out of this problem, nor can women's income levels buy their way out of this problem. It tells us that something is inherently wrong with the system that is not valuing Black women's lives equally to white women's lives. And while I've spent a lot of time talking about the maternal mortality and morbidity issues, we cannot ignore the heartbreaking fact that Black infants are twice as likely as white infants to die before their first birthday. Nor can we ignore the important research of Dr. Hardiman that found Black newborns die less when cared for by Black doctors. This raises the important questions of why and the even more important question of how do we change this deadly trend? House File 660 would require hospitals with obstetric care and birthing centers to have annual evidence-based continuing education around systemic racism, maternal mortality, and morbidity issues. We've worked with many stakeholders on this language and have plans for more stakeholder input around the midwifery and doula care portion of the bill. We anticipate an amendment that will be completed in time for when this bill comes back to the committee for consideration of the fiscal note. The bill would also expand our maternal health studies to include morbidity events that meet the CDC's definition. Studying mortality and studying morbidity and the near misses is an excellent way to gather information, learn, and promote prevention. Because to be clear, we can prevent many of these deaths. Finally, the bill would also address increasing awareness of future providers. Today, Madam Chair, I also have with me Brittany Wright, a maternal health advocate, to testify in support of the bill.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Richardson. Brittany Wright, welcome. Please just give your name and then just tell us who you're with, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Greeting committee members and community members. My name is Brittany L. Wright. I am a social impact strategist with Gray Matter and the Director of Holistic Maternal Care Advocacy and Multimedia with Trill Moms. Trill Moms is an initiative dedicated to centering the narrative and lived experience of Black mothers through public policy, multimedia, and holistic maternal care advocacy. I'm here to support the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act led by Representative Ruth Richardson for a few reasons. One of them is very personal. When I was 7 months pregnant, I moved across the country from the Twin Cities to Boston, Massachusetts. Data shows that Minnesota is the second best place in the country to give birth, with Massachusetts being the first. So in theory, I was in really good hands, but I spent the last 3 months of my pregnancy, when I should have been nesting, preparing to bring life into the world, getting my daughter's nursery set up. Instead, I sat on the internet for days at a time, for weeks, which led into months, bracing myself for the possibility of death, researching day and night which medical facilities were the least likely to let my child and I die. And if you're wondering if there is a magic algorithm that can help save you or protect you from dying during childbirth, there's not. There's actually no way to even know which hospitals at this current moment acknowledge Black maternal mortality, Black infant maternal mortality and morbidity. And so it's my recommendation and my encouragement that all of you support this bill and continue to lean into the research that Dr. Hardiman has brought forward. It's terrifying to be a Black woman bringing a child into the world right now. During my birth, I developed an intrapartum fever. It crossed the placenta, and I gave birth with a fever, and my daughter was born with a fever. And when the fever developed, I felt physically cold and began shivering, but that led to convulsing uncontrollably. I lost full control of my body and the ability to speak and advocate for myself. At the time, I was married, and so my husband yelled for a nurse to come in, and I received some medicine to help my body fight the fever and to stop the convulsing. But had he not been there, I'm not sure what exactly would have happened to my body. I very well could have been one of those women, another statistic that Representative Richardson and Dr. Hardiman have mentioned. When I went to my postpartum checkup 6 weeks after giving birth, my midwife said that the fever did cross the placenta, and therefore I wouldn't be able to encapsulate it. And they're not quite sure what happened, but now that I'm out of labor and delivery, that I should be fine. Now, traditionally, the only additional checkup that a woman has after giving birth is at that 6 week appointment. So according to what this medical professional told me, I should have been just fine despite the complications that I experienced during labor and delivery. But this was not the case. In fact, I returned to that same medical institution 56 times within the first year of my daughter's life. My daughter is now 2, and I am still dealing with the complications of her birth. This is why I created a framework called Holistic Maternal Care. It supports bills like the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act and implores medical professionals, policymakers, and community members alike to, number one, listen to Black women. I believe there was a representative who asked about the studies that were of success. What are the places where good work is happening, and what models can be replicated? Where there have been models in other parts of the country where by simply intentionally listening to Black patients, they have significantly decreased their rates of maternal mortality and morbidity. Two, holistic maternal care points to acknowledging the historic trauma of birthing within the United States explicitly. The study of obstetrics and gynecology was birthed out of the exploitation of Black women's bodies. James Marion Sims, who invented so many of the tools and surgeries that are used today in obstetrics and gynecology, advanced his practices and his studies and made the developments that he made by researching on enslaved women of African descent and performing surgeries on them without anesthesia. So there is a history to why these disparities happen and how and why they disproportionately impact Black women, and it's systemic. And so it's incredibly important while we look at the data to make sure that Black women are centered and that there is reparative care that acknowledges the ways in which we have been exploited through the process of labor and delivery. By integrating cultural rituals back into prenatal labor and delivery and postpartum care, we can do the work to make sure that Black women feel safe and supported. For me, I was lucky enough to have a husband in the room with me who was making well over 6 figures. I had just graduated from my Ivy League program a month before I gave birth, and none of that saved me from what I experienced in labor and delivery. None of that prevented me from the postpartum challenges that I'm still facing 2 years later. So I want us to also be very clear that the way in which we speak about Black women and the causes of Black infant and maternal mortality and morbidity shouldn't be looked at from the framework of what did the mother do wrong, especially when we know that historically there have been reasons why Black women are treated the way in which they do, and your socioeconomic status unfortunately does not save you. I wholeheartedly believe by centering mothers in media campaigns and in the representation of hospitals, birthing centers, and other medical organizations that we can begin to humanize motherhood and decolonize motherhood, allowing people to see Black women as worthy of bringing life forth into the world without harm, without bias, and without projections that are often misrepresented within the media. I also believe that it's imperative that we support mothers beyond their six-week postpartum checkup. As I mentioned, at my six-week postpartum checkup, I got a green light. I was healthy, despite the fact that I had had some complications during birth. And yet here we are 2 years later, and I am dealing with a host of complications that were actually triggered from the moment that I developed a fever during birth. So with policies like the Dignity in Pregnancy and Childbirth Act, we can collectively do the work to ensure that women have a right to a safe and healthy birth experience and postpartum experience by ensuring that they get the care that they need, even when they check out, even beyond the six-week checkup, and that we don't just focus on the deaths, but the near deaths, not the mortality, but the morbidity as well, the injuries. How do women's bodies change? How are they impacted? And are we as a collective doing the work to support mothers? For me personally, I can say no, but it's my hope and it's my belief that through calls like this, that we can all do the work together, and through bills like the one that Representative Richardson has brought forth, through research like the work that Dr. Hardiman has done, there is so much possibility for us to create safe space for mothers to birth in a safe manner, and especially acknowledging that these disparities are disproportionately impacting women who happen to look like me. And so I will yield my time and say thank you for taking the time to discuss this issue. You never know what a woman may be going through when she enters into becoming a mother, and it's my hope that she can do so in a safe manner. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wright. Really happy to have you with us today. Thank you. Ann Krisnick is here to testify. Welcome, Ms. Krisnick. Please introduce yourself and tell us who you're with.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann Krisnick. I'm Executive Director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which is made up of the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. And I'm testifying here in support of the bill. You've heard a lot about disparities, health care disparities among white women and indigenous women and Black women. And I'm not going to repeat that, but I want to share that our faith leaders across Minnesota see day after day the families that are impacted by each of these deaths and the grieving spouses and partners and parents and children and people in the community. We want to really urge you to support whatever we can do to change the current rates of maternal mortality, especially among Indigenous and Black women. And we want to specifically speak to the portions of the bill that include study of maternal morbidity and access to data on prenatal care, on what happened during delivery, and on care after pregnancy, access to the Medicaid data regarding that. We currently review cases that have the most awful possible outcome and look at what happened. And this bill authorizes studying those cases where there was a really serious medical incident, but there was a good outcome. And we need to learn from those, and we need to see what happened and how we ended up with those good outcomes. We really look forward to seeing what we'll learn as we go forward with that. And with that, we urge you to support House File 660. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Krisnick. Are there any questions from members? I'm not seeing any. So I know that somebody from the Department of Health is here if there were questions. I don't know if anybody from Health wants to speak to the bill at all. Probably not. So, okay. Well, I think then, okay, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't resist. Representative Richardson, thank you so much for pulling all of the different elements of this important bill together. I'm really hopeful that you're going to get this across the finish line, and this is going to really start to impact the challenges that we have in Minnesota. So mainly, it's a thank you. And I'm also really glad to see the studying of maternal, bolstering the study of maternal, severe maternal morbidity. Because as Dr. Hardiman pointed out, maternal mortality, thankfully, is a rare event in spite of the disproportionate impacts in our state and across the country on Black and Indigenous women. But we have many who are harmed, and you gave the famous example of Serena Williams by severe maternal morbidity. So we really, it's important that we study those near misses, those events where women could very well have died or were harmed either permanently or otherwise in a way that alters potentially the course of their lives and therefore their children's lives as well. So I think that's an important part of many important parts of the bill. And I want to thank you for your hard work on this, Representative Richardson.
All right, Representative Richardson, before we move to a vote, do you have any final words for us?
Just thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present today. And I also would just like to give thanks to Brittany Wright as well as an amazing advocate and Dr. Rachel Hardiman for all of her work and support within this bill as well. And to just ask for member support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Richardson. So Representative, I'm going to renew the motion on behalf of Representative Richardson to that House File 660 as amended be recommended to be referred to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. And in this in virtual environment, we have to take the roll. So Chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland. Representative Ackland. Representative Backer.
Backer votes aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damoth.
Damoth, aye.
Damoth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Freiberg, aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grinhagen.
Aye.
Grinhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott. Excused. And I see Representative Ackland has her hand up, and I'm wondering if...
I'm sorry, I had a technical glitch, and I'm an aye.
Okay, Ackland, aye.
Thank you.
17 ayes and 0 nays.
All right, there being 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is recommended to be re-referred to Judiciary. So thank you again, Representative Richardson. Thank you, members. So end of a busy week for us, and we will let you know soon what will be on the agenda next week. And with that, you get a few minutes of your life back, and we are adjourned.